This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The natural world is disappearing. Species extinction rates are now 1,000 times higher than they were before the spread of humanity. Unless we move quickly to protect global biodiversity, we will soon lose most of the species composing life on Earth. Currently, about 15% of the land and 3% of the oceans are protected. We have to increase that. Only by committing half of the planet's surface can we hope to halt the decline.
How much of the planet does nature need to keep on going? It's a big question. In 2017, famed American biologist E.O. Wilson said we need to protect half of Earth to avoid a deadly mass extinction of species. That has been refined as the Global Deal for Nature, and one of the architects of that deal is Dr. Eric Dinnerstein. For 25 years, Eric was chief scientist at the World Wildlife Fund, or WWF. He is now with the NGO called Resolve. He leads their program on biodiversity and wildlife solutions. And I think this may be our best and last chance to save nature. From Washington, D.C., Eric Dinnerstein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on.
What are conservation plans like this one trying to avoid?
I think that what we're trying to avoid is climate breakdown and massive biodiversity loss that will lead to major extinctions in our time, and to create essentially a livable biosphere that we can hand on to future generations.
So why do we need to save so much land and sea for nature to operate kind of without us?
You know, it would be really helpful right from the beginning if, starting from this show, your listeners can start to think of climate and biodiversity together in the same sentence. And that's critical because what the latest science is telling us, both atmospheric science and biodiversity science, is that the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis are interlinked, and we cannot save biodiversity without maintaining a stable climate, and we can't avoid climate breakdown unless we save biodiversity. So that's kind of the biggest headline. Now, under that is a basic truth, a fact that's come from atmospheric sciences, is that half of all, some estimate 50%, some say 60%, but let's say more than half of all the greenhouse gas emissions that are induced by, generated by humans, are absorbed in our land sinks, in our ocean sinks. So we're getting this amazing ecosystem service for free, basically, by just maintaining natural habitat. If we lose a fair amount of habitat on land, we not only emit more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when forests burn, for example, or land is cleared and then burned, but also carbon, greenhouse gases can be released from the ground, like methane, particularly like up in Canada, in Alaska, or Russia, that areas of permafrost, if they melt as well, will start emitting greenhouse gases and create this extremely dangerous feedback loop that could threaten really all of nature and a good deal of humanity. So the simplest solution to trying to avoid climate breakdown and to save biodiversity is to protect half, to protect those carbon sinks and to protect the biodiversity that's in it.
Where does this number of half or 50% of Earth for nature come from? I mean, surely somebody didn't just pull it out of a hat. There must be some science behind it.
There is. So first on the biodiversity side, what we did in the Global Deal for Nature, which we can get to. So the Global Deal for Nature is a time-bound, science-based approach to saving life on Earth. And it's time-bound in the sense that we have to do this on a fairly accelerated schedule, and it's science-based. So here is the science for the biodiversity part. We took all of the most widely used biodiversity data layers, so to speak, like where are all the birds, the mammals, the reptiles, amphibians, where are they found only in a single place? That's called endemism, so it's quite rare. Where are all the plants? And so we think of it as, how do we add these layers that then, when they're amalgamated, tell us from the computer analysis how much land we need and how much marine area do we need? And the answer comes up very close to 50%. So simply put, we need about 46% in our calculation for biodiversity and carbon storage, another 6% or so for additional climate stabilization, just to keep the natural vegetation intact. It doesn't require intensive management, just to avoid emissions. And then in a new paper we're doing that we're about to release, we asked a question that nobody has asked before. What would it take to connect all of the world's protected areas and intact habitats? And the answer to that is remarkably small, only about 2.8% of the Earth's surface. So you combine those three elements and you come to about 52% that's needed, and that can be a blueprint for saving life on land. And then in marine, there are other analyses that are ongoing now that show roughly between 30 and 50% are also needed. So that's where the number comes from. It's based on the best science that we have and the best rationales for what are the biodiversity targets we're trying to conserve.
Well, as you know, a new paper published in the journal Nature Sustainability offers a criticism, or at least a caution, about the global deal for nature. It was led by Dr. Judith Schleicher and co-authored by Chris Sandbrook of Cambridge, and he is our next guest. What did you think about their paper titled Protecting Half of the Planet Could Directly Affect Over 1 Billion People?
Well, we offer a counter perspective in the reply to that, which is that they have the number wrong, that protecting half the planet, let's turn that on its head. Not protecting half the planet could affect 7.8 billion people and the 10 billion people who likely will be on Earth by 2050, because we are all living in the same biosphere and we need to have clean air and we need to have a good living environment. This is the problem with that paper and papers that social scientists usually write. And if I could make a plea, I would just ask that social scientists, please don't skip over the atmospheric and biodiversity science like the nature sustainability critique does. By skipping over that, you're missing just the preamble I gave earlier in your show, that if we don't conserve 50% of land and marine areas, that we won't sequester the carbon that's needed to have a livable biosphere. So basically what we need to do to stay below 1.5 degrees C, which is the goal that every atmospheric scientist embraces now, and the UN panel as well, is we can get there if we apply nature-based solutions like the Global Deal for Nature, plus transition to renewable energy as fast as we can, but definitely by 2050. So there is a pathway here to have a thriving planet, a thriving life on Earth, but we have to act now. We can't wait till 2050. We're suggesting by 2030 to try to protect 30% at least on land and another 20% in what's called other important conservation areas, that many of which are indigenous lands, and we can touch upon that as well. But basically, the biggest critique is that they're missing the big picture here, is that if we don't do this, how are we going to avoid the climate catastrophe of environmental refugees, of the droughts that we see, the catastrophic forest fires we've seen in California and Australia, many linked to climate change, sea level rise? It's one thing to criticize something, and I totally understand that. That's a big part of academic life. But I'd like to hear some of the same academics. What answer do you have? What proposal do you have that could sustain life on Earth, given the crises that we face with climate breakdown and the loss of biodiversity? We're happy to listen and discuss that.
Some critics of the Global Deal for Nature complain about the cost of sealing away all those resources and lands, but you take on the cost of the deal in your paper, and it sounds like actually it's pretty inexpensive. You found about $100 billion a year in costs, but the U.S. spends $639 billion for military alone. So it doesn't seem like cost is that great compared to the threat we face.
It's not. Very good point, Alex. It's not the cost, it's the political will. So it would be about $100 billion a year. You know, it may be plus or minus $10 billion, but that's not so important. The other comparison besides the military is what fossil fuel subsidies are. And here are the fossil fuel industry getting subsidies to exacerbate the problem if we spent some of that even just on trying to maintain the natural habitats that would offset all those emissions, it would be a tremendous breakthrough. Yours was military. Mine is something like, I think just in the United States alone, we spend $33 billion a year on pet food and grooming. So it's not that big a price, you know, for the world to step up and do this. And we're working hard with a number of groups to try to find those resources quickly to make this big difference happen.
But I take your point. I mean, suppose it's true. It would be hard. It would be costly. It would be unpopular to save half the earth for the wild. But what is the other choice? What happens if we just pick a growth economy instead and plow ahead as we're doing?
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge. You know, when also people say it's going to be hard because let's go through some of the other complaints about the global deal for nature. And some are in the Schleicher and Sandburg paper, which are simply not true. They make assumptions about what's in the two papers they cite, of which I'm involved in. And the first is that making the assumption that we're trying to conserve 50% of every ecoregion. So there's 846 ecoregions in the world, terrestrial ecoregions. Alex, you're out there on the edge of British Columbia and the U.S. in the Okanagan. And so you're in the Okanagan dry forest. Isn't that more romantic to call it that than just B.C.? And we all live in an ecoregion. You can go to a map of the world at ecoregions2017.appspot.com, which we did with Google, and you can move the mouse around and find out what ecoregion you live in. Okay, if you scroll over to some of the places, like in Canada and the U.S., for example, where the major agricultural areas are, where you have row agriculture of wheat, corn, soybeans, we're never saying that we should try to maintain 50% or put into conservation 50% of all the world's ecoregions. That would be ludicrous in like the tall grass prairie of the United States and forking up into Canada. That's 98% corn and soybeans. So of the 846 ecoregions, there's 207 where the average amount of natural habitat remaining, protected or unprotected, is less than 20%. And for those 207 ecoregions, the average is only 4%. So these are heavily converted. They're the place of intensive food production. And we would never say, try and get these to 50%. Similarly, places that have huge population densities, all the metropolitan areas, before we do our analysis of where could we get to 50%, we filter out all the places where the cities and towns and major metropolitan areas. So that's another critique of the paper that you mentioned that's totally bogus, because I think they even mention that London would have to be put under conservation. Our message to Londoners is keep calm and carry on. That's just a mistake of their methods. We don't put London or Rome or Tokyo or New York or Vancouver or Los Angeles under conservation. You know, all those population areas are masked out. Even when you do that in the analysis, there's still plenty of land left. You know, in the United States, for example, 80% of people live in metropolitan areas. And it's an amazing map, if you've ever seen one, of a 3D map with mountains, very steep mountains that symbolize the densities of people per square mile. And it shows very large areas, even in the United States with, you know, over 300 million people, where there's plenty of opportunity for conservation. And that's true in a number of ecoregions. In fact, to get to half, there are over 100 ecoregions that have already exceeded 50% protection. We should get to indigenous lands, too, because I think that's another important point, but you might want to have another question.
Well, no, why don't you talk to us about indigenous lands? I do want to hear about that.
Sure. You know, I think that this is the other mistake that is in that paper, and really not that paper, but just sort of writ large, what other people who are social scientists or anthropologists criticize and assume that we want to take land away from indigenous groups. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's just the opposite. In fact, I would say that we are the biggest defenders of indigenous lands and indigenous people to have authority and to have the determination of what their lands should be used for, whether it's conservation or not. And fortunately, almost all of the response has been from indigenous groups. Is this an endorsement of the Global Deal for Nature? I didn't attend the Convention on Biological Diversity scientific meeting, which is going on right now in Montreal, But what we've been told is that indigenous groups are firmly behind the global deal for nature because it recognizes the contribution that their lands are making to a sustainable biosphere, and it's in line with their way of thinking. You know, one of the things that we've always said about our Nature Needs Half initiative, Alex, is that there are three pillars. You know, one is climate science, and another is biodiversity science, but the third is indigenous knowledge and wisdom. One of our co-authors in this response to Schleicher and Sandbrook is not far from where you are, Julie Kajun. She's from the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. And her point is that what she says is, like, our ancestors understood that a life of reciprocity with one another and our world was essential to well-being, not just for current generations in the world, but also for the unborn and the world of the future. Elders tell us that we are the youngest brother and sister of creation. Everything came before us. This perspective affords us humility, reverence, and understanding of the value of the natural world. It is troubling when conservation discussions focus primarily on human needs, and we would remind everyone again that we are the youngest and that we are dependent on the well-being of all that was here before us. Taking care of the natural world is taking care of us and thinking of our grandchildren and those to come. Let us consider that societal and human economic needs can best be addressed by more humane policies, laws, and governments. Nature Needs Half values nature and humanity. You know, and I would just add to that, that with the youth movements going on today, like Extinction Rebellion and the voice of Greta Thunberg and her colleagues, is that we should listen to the youth movements to sense in the injustice, because that's a term that the social scientists often use, the injustice of this bold idea of Nature Needs Half. But you can look at that again from a different perspective, the injustice that future generations will experience if we fail to respond by enacting big solutions now. And so it depends. I'd love to see, rather than me, I'd love to see Judith Schleicher and Chris Sandbrook debate Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion and some climate scientists. I think that would be worth paying money to go see, because I think that they would be awakened as to the youth movement that refuses to accept what they're about to inherit. And so when the social scientists criticize bold conservation plans, I guess I come back to what I started with earlier. What's your alternative to save life on Earth? Happy to hear it and discuss that. But give us something on paper other than just to critique other people's ideas without offering anything of your own.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with my guest, the famed conservationist and scientist Eric Dinnerstein, and we're talking about a global deal for nature to save our living heritage. Your paper says, quote, in recent years, more than 60% of global emissions from natural habitats, which accounted for 15% of annual greenhouse gas emissions, stemmed from clearing and fires in just two provinces, Real Province in Sumatra, Indonesia, and Mato Grosso in Brazil. And, quote, that is stunning. Why can't somebody declare an emergency and act quickly to protect the atmosphere from these two top carbon hotspots?
Well, it's a really good question. And in the case of Real Province, there is a lot of problems with the spread of palm oil. The high price of palm oil is a strong attractor for different forces to go and clear land, sell off the timber, and then plant oil palm, which offers a very good return on investment. But what it also does in Riau is it shuts down Singapore and affects Kuala Lumpur and affects a huge swath of Southeast Asia from the pollution from those fires lit by those converting tropical forests. What's worse is that Riau sits on some of the world's great peat reserves. And you probably know that the last thing we want to do is to set forests above peat on fire, because those fires can continue to burn. And that's where a disproportionate amount of the world's carbon is stored in these peat forests, largely in the tropics, but also in the boreal forest of Canada and Russia. We want to keep that in the ground. So yeah, this is a huge problem. Now it's more than just those two provinces. There are others. But this is why I think, if anything that your listeners come away from this program, I would suggest that one of the most important moves forward is to break down the silos that exist between the climate scientists and climate science and the climate convention and biodiversity scientists and the biodiversity convention, because the two are so interdependent. We can't solve one problem without the other. We have to start thinking in tandem. And if we do that, I'm very hopeful that we're going to have a lasting solution that can lead to a thriving biosphere. But we have to start acting now.
Okay, now, Eric, what if we protect half the Earth by land and sea, and then pollutants like microplastic beads or toxic rain or nuclear radiation seeps through all systems? Can we really draw areas on a map and maintain barriers and rules?
Great question. And in fact, in the Global Deal for Nature, we have land-based targets, which you just referred to conserve half. And we also have policy interventions, so addressing plastics, addressing other forms of pollution that are pervasive, and that even if you established 50% protected on land and in the sea, it wouldn't be enough if you didn't have, for example, regulations. Let's go beyond plastics and consider a few more issues of great import. If we didn't have the effort to reduce or remove subsidies to fishing fleets that are basically mining the ocean, you know, we're conducting the greatest hunting expedition ever for top predators that goes on every single day. If we just established no-take zones in key protected areas around the world, we could have restore an abundant fisheries. So that's all possible. The other is, you know, just establishing large areas in Africa, as you probably know, doesn't do enough to protect populations of endangered elephants or rhinos or in Asia, tigers that roam over large areas. Is that we have to have strict laws and enforcement and incentive packages and local development around critical reserves so that we can maintain and even increase these populations of endangered large mammals, which is one of the first groups to go in the current extinction crisis. So I think that there's a lot that can be done on the policy side, too, with good enforcement. But it requires that we, you know, become much better stewards of the Earth, or future generations will never forgive us.
The global deal calls for us to save 50% for nature, but nature is alive everywhere, as you know, even in the middle of cities. Is half enough? And can we just pave over our share?
No, I think that we need to do conservation in urban areas as well, and there are some wonderful examples of that in cities and towns. You know, Alex, I've worked for several decades around the world when I was chief scientist at World Wildlife Fund and now for the last 5 years at Resolve. And in my travels in developing countries, I lived in the country of Nepal for 8 years. I've worked all over Asia and parts of Africa and Latin America. I've never heard once somebody say to me in a rural area, in a remote place where there's still good nature, I want to live next to a degraded environment. Nobody's ever said that to me. And I'm not being facetious here. Is I think that there's something really fundamental and there's an evolutionary basis to it, is that we all want to live next to a place that's attractive, that has clean water and clean air, that has healthy soils. That's fundamental to just about everybody. And I think that that's what we build on, is nobody wants to live next to a degraded environment. And even in cities, I think that people appreciate parks. I think the cities of the future will be a lot more greener than some of the cities that we have now.
This December, the latest climate conference, COP25, was just held in Madrid. How does the Global Deal for Nature fit in with the Paris Climate Accord?
I think it fits in perfectly, but I think that I articulated the challenge before is we have to stop thinking in silos. We have to think that the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis are deeply interlinked. Let me give you one example. If on the climate side, if we don't protect coral reefs, well, if we don't address staying below 1.5 degrees C, average global rise in temperature, and it goes to 2 degrees, it's not a linear reaction, so to speak. It's that the coral reefs essentially bleach out and die. When that happens, that there's approximately 1.5 billion people who gain their protein from tropical seas that involve reef systems and nearshore systems like mangroves. What happens to that protein source when the coral reefs disappear? And just that jump from 1.5 to 2 degrees can make that happen. Similarly, on the biodiversity side, we've had a long, long period of evolution where nature has shaped the evolution of these things called trees that not only form beautiful forests that sequester lots and lots of carbon and also provide all this habitat for so many rare species. What most people don't understand, and one of the critical aspects of conservation biology and its goals, is that many species on Earth are rare. Relatively few species are common. So what we're mostly trying to do is conserve rare species. And by rare, I mean species that are limited to a small geographic area, are relatively live at a low density, or both. And those are the things we target in the Global Deal for Nature, as well as the wide-ranging species that go on migrations like the caribou of Canada and Alaska, or pronghorn antelope, or other species out west, or the Serengeti migrations in Africa, is that these endangered biological phenomena are also critical targets. So from the narrowest range beetle living in the canopy of some Amazon tree to the caribou marching across the tundra, that's all part of biodiversity, and that's what we're trying to save in the Global Deal for Nature.
Okay, now, how can we do this? What institutions or what machinery exists to agree on this and to implement the Global Deal for Nature?
Now you're getting into the hard part. In some ways, it's easier to do the science and to articulate what we're trying to conserve in papers and to convince the governments to set aside more land. In some places, it's easy. They're already doing it. In others, it's a bigger challenge. But I think that we have to start thinking longer term. We can't think about just tomorrow and the next amount of profit we're going to get from cutting down a rainforest to plant oil palm and release all these greenhouse gas emissions that are going to make our planet unlivable. And so I think that some of the institutions are not quite, well, to say that they move at a glacial pace is a little exaggeration, but they don't move that quickly. And that's the biggest problem that I see, is that we have a timeline where we need to transition to, you know, completely rely on renewable energy by 2050. All the models pretty much point in that direction, and we need to conserve half of the land and half the ocean to avoid the emissions from land, and particularly things like permafrost, to avoid conversion or avoid, it becomes a feedback loop. We cut down boreal forests, the fires go up, the atmosphere gets warmer, and we end up with melting of permafrost. The plan that we have in the Global Deal for Nature seems radical to some degree for some people. But, Alex, you know, one observation I've made over the last few years where new climate models come out, no new model has ever suggested, you know what, you guys, you're overthinking this. You're way too concerned. Actually, the window and the timetable has been extended. We have a lot more time to try to get below 2 degrees C, and we can experiment with new technologies to do that. Just the opposite. It's the timelines are growing shorter with new scientific information. So my point is that what may seem somewhat radical today might seem conservative in 5 or 10 years when we get new models that probably tell us just how much faster climate change has accelerated over the last few years than we ever thought.
Well, we're running out of time, but last quick question. What were you working on when I called you up?
So I've got a number of different projects I work on. Aside from global biodiversity issues and trying to save life on Earth, it's a little more specific, is what I talked about earlier of the extinction of large mammals in African reserves and reserves elsewhere that conserve wildlife. We've come up with the world's first end-to-end camera-based anti-poaching system, basically a burglar alarm for national parks that is very cheap. The batteries last for a year and a half, and it uses artificial intelligence powered by Intel, our close collaborators in this whole effort. It's called TrailGuard AI, and it's coming to a park in Africa very, very soon. I'm assembling them right now with my staff.
Sounds exciting. We've been speaking with Dr. Eric Dinnerstein, long known to the public as Chief Scientist for the World Wildlife Fund. He is now with Resolve, and you can find him at resolve.ngo. You can find the paper, A Global Deal for Nature, Guiding Principles, Milestones, and Targets, as a free paper at advances.sciencemag.org, or get the links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you for sharing all this with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Like it or not, we are the mind of the living world. We must now become its guardian and steward. To strive against the odds on behalf of all of life would be humanity at its most noble. We can share this precious planet of ours. All life can prosper. This is my dream.
Are you worried that beloved creatures are disappearing? So how can we save the rest of nature? There's a lot of talk about that. In 2017, the famous biologist E.O. Wilson proposed the book Half Earth, and he was suggesting we reserve half the planet for wild things if we want to avoid that sad and dangerous time when species go extinct. The idea has been refined into the Global Deal for Nature, but now a group of European scientists questions how that could work. Dr. Chris Sandbrook is a co-author of the paper, Protecting Half of the Planet Could Directly Affect Over 1 Billion People. It was published in Nature Sustainability in November 2019. Sandbrook is a senior lecturer at Cambridge and oversees a master's program in conservation leadership. Chris Sandbrook, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, a lot of us do fear that things around us may disappear slowly or unnoticed. It's a kind of eco-anxiety. Do you feel that?
Yes, I absolutely do, and I think it's a real problem that we face in conservation is something that we call shifting baseline syndrome, which is this idea that every generation experiences a different and an increasingly depleted ecology that they grow up with. So when we think back to our childhood about how things used to be, that's what I think of is going to be different to what my parents thought of or what my grandparents thought of. And so we kind of think that things aren't changing so much when actually they're changing a lot. And we do experience anxiety as we see things disappearing around us. It can be very damaging to our mental health.
So in answer to these concerns, how much of the world's land and sea have major governments agreed to set aside for the preservation of nature?
So the current set of targets which governments around the world have committed to under the Convention for Biological Diversity is a terrestrial target of 17%. Of coverage and a marine target of 10%, and the target there was by 2020, so by next year. And on land, we're not far off hitting that target. I believe the current figure is somewhere around about 15%. And in the oceans, we're a little bit further behind, but making quite rapid advances as more and more countries are declaring marine protected areas. So I think there's some possibility of hitting those numbers, although I'm not tracking it by the minute.
And would biologists and specialists think that that is enough?
Well, no would be the straightforward answer for most people. I think, however, the big caveat to that is a lot of it depends on how these areas are actually looked after. So one of the problems we face at the moment is a kind of focus just on a number. So this idea that, you know, we need to have a particular number that we aim for. And actually, a lot of the issues are really around how land is being managed. So a lot of protected areas are not really very well protected in practice. But also, I think we need to think about all the areas that are outside protected areas and what we can do to try to conserve biodiversity in farmland and in cities and in, you know, basically everywhere on Earth, rather than just focusing on a, you know, a small proportion of the planet.
So how would you describe the Global Deal for Nature?
Well, so the Global Deal for Nature, as I understand it, and I won't claim, you know, it's not my idea, so I won't claim I can speak about it with great authority, is a plan which has been put forward to try to conserve biodiversity over the next coming decades by scaling up radically the current coverage of protected areas on land and in the sea, and also by trying to tackle some of the underlying drivers of biodiversity loss in things like agriculture and the overconsumption of fish species and so on that we have a problem with at the moment.
And as a senior lecturer at Cambridge, do you think the numbers behind this idea of half are solid scientifically? I mean, maybe we really need two-thirds or maybe we need much less than that. Do we know?
Well, I think there are two sides to answering that question. One is sort of technical and the other is more about underlying value. So if your starting point is that, you know, we want to avoid losing any species or we want to, achieve certain goals in terms of climate change and so on, then you can certainly make a good argument from biogeography and other kind of conservation science that half may be a bit bigger to aim at. But I think you also need to think about that in terms of the underlying values, as I said. So some people have that as their top priority, is avoiding extinction of any species. Other people are more concerned or equally concerned about other important issues facing us as a society, issues around about environmental justice and equity for different people. And I think once you bring these different factors into play, then what looks like the right answer may start to look a little bit different.
Well, we're going to discuss eco-justice more in just a minute, but if the Global Deal for Nature was implemented, as suggested by Eric Dinnerstein's group, how many more humans would be affected by that?
Well, so the analysis which we have done in the paper which we've just published looks at what would happen if half of all eco-regions in the world were put into protected areas, and eco-regions are... There are several hundred ecoregions which define different categories of habitat, different types of ecosystems that we find on the planet. If we put half of all of those into protected areas to achieve that half Earth ambition, our analysis suggests that you would end up with over 1 billion people living in the areas, or who currently live in the areas, that would then be in protected areas. And so the big question then is, what would happen to those people? Would they be able to continue living in those places? And if not, where would they go? And if they could continue to live in those places, how would their lives be affected by the kind of new introduced protections that would come with that deal? Now, the Global Deal for Nature, as it stands at the moment, is not aiming for the 50% target. It's aiming for a 30% target, but as a kind of milestone on the track towards a 50% target in the future. So we haven't actually done the analysis at this stage that looks at the 30% target and what the impact of that would be, but I think we can assume it would be proportionally smaller than what we found in our study, but nonetheless a significant and likely impact on the people who are residents in those areas. And I think just to say, it's really important to stress that in our study, we're not saying or collectively saying this is necessarily a terrible thing. I think what we're trying to do is simply call attention to the very real issue of these are large numbers of people who are living their lives in the way they are at present, and we need to think really carefully about what would happen to such people if this kind of plan were to be implemented. Clearly, achieving conservation goals is going to require some quite major action to be taken, and it's going to cause opportunities and costs for lots of different people. But we really need to understand the kind of scale of the social impacts that we're considering before we can make some informed choices about the way forward.
Well, a 2018 paper led by Zia Marabi talked about the possible agricultural losses. She was talking 15 to 31% of crop per land and 14 to 45% of pasture land, and a lot of food calories from crops could be lost if half the Earth's terrestrial ecoregions were given back to nature. And I could see that as prohibitive, and so we can't do it, too much loss of food for humanity, or we could read those numbers as a measure of the size of our over-encroachment on nature already. Are we past some limits, and do we know even where those limits are?
Yes, it's a very interesting study, the one that you mentioned, and I think I see it as our piece is, in a sense, kind of a natural progression from that piece of research. They were looking at food specifically, and we're looking at the kind of population numbers involved in the impact that might be felt. Yeah, your question is a very good one, and in a sense almost impossible to answer. I mean, we're on a trajectory towards a population size which is going to be very challenging for the planet to support in a sustainable way and without a considerable loss of biodiversity. I don't think it's impossible that we can support a larger population than we have at present, but I think it's really very urgently requiring attention to the consumption levels we have in the West. I think if we're going to be able to sustain a larger human population on Earth, then we need to radically degrow and downscale our economies in the countries like the US and Canada and the UK, where we and many of your listeners are based. At the same time, as thinking about what we can do to conserve biodiversity in largely tropical countries where so much of it is found. So I think we can't possibly talk about radically scaling up protection in the global south without simultaneously radically scaling down demand in the global north. To do anything else would be just frankly unfair.
Right. And you talk about in the paper, if we were very strict about saving every ecozone, then we would have to turn a part of London into a conservation area. I don't think anybody suggested that, but it is interesting to think about that as an idea. Perhaps part of London could become a conservation area, and how we would have to green cities to be part of this program.
Yeah, so that was just an interesting thing that came out of our analysis. So when we were looking at, well, the process that we took was to say if we allocated additional land within each eco-region to get up to that 50% target, we did that in a way that tried to minimize the human footprint index score for the areas that we added. And so we were trying to do it in a way that would have the minimum possible impact on people and then see how many people lived in those areas. As it turned out, in the eco-region in southeast England, the last pixel that was allocated in that process was an area of London. And you're right, I think that was probably more of an artifact of problems with the human footprint index map than any kind of, you know, there are clearly other places in southeast England that would be more obviously sensible to create protected areas. But I think it does nonetheless help to illustrate the fact that, you know, we're not talking here about large tracts of, you know, relatively intact forest somewhere with a, you know, a small population of indigenous people living in them. We are talking about really seriously populated areas like the southeast of England. Just to come to the second part of your point, though, about whether we need to think about conservation in urban areas, well, certainly we do. I think there's a lot of interesting work going on in that space and a lot of value that people can get for their mental health and well-being from having opportunities to access nature in urban areas. Those places will rarely contain rare and endemic species, which are of a very high priority from a biodiversity conservation point of view, but they can nonetheless be hugely valuable for resident people. And there is actually a proposal to convert London into, or to brand London as a national park city, which I think, you know, conservation purists might raise an eyebrow or two at what that means in practice, because clearly it's a very large, you know, global metropolis. But there is a lot of concern about conservation in London, and it's quite a green city, and they want to kind of claim it as a national park city.
So as your paper acknowledges, some nature preserves have benefited local people, and I think of marine conservation areas, which then spawned a bigger catch for commercial fishers in the long run. Is it accurate to say that most of the resistance to setting nature aside comes from local people rather than the broad electorate?
Yes, I think that is fair. I mean, I agree with you that there are some really positive examples where protecting nature in protected areas can be beneficial to local people, and some marine protected areas are a great example of that. But unfortunately, there are many examples where creating protected areas is harmful to resident populations and is resisted. So many examples of people being evicted or displaced, either physically or economically, you know, to make way for the protected areas, and losing access to livelihoods or to traditional lands and cultural sites and so on. So very often the resistance to conservation does come from the local level, and that's often because it's local people who tend to bear the highest cost of conserving areas, which whereas the benefits are spread much more widely. So, you know, I feel a benefit from the fact that there are tigers being protected in India because I care about tigers, but I don't have to live with the cost of tigers, you know, being protected in my neighborhood in terms of lost access to land or the risk of being attacked by a tiger. So it's that uneven distribution of costs and benefits which is kind of a profoundly challenging problem for conservation, because it creates concerns about justice and fairness.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
This is Radio EcoShock, speaking with Dr. Chris Sandbrook from the University of Cambridge about a global deal for nature. And you do feel strongly about eco-justice, Chris. Why?
Well, okay, so I think just on terminology, there are various different language for these things flying around. So what I personally care a lot about is what I would call environmental justice, which is really about trying to make sure that conservation is done in a way which is fair to often poor and marginalized people who have historically suffered at the hands of conservation in many cases. And, you know, conservation has its origins in kind of colonial policies that were implemented, you know, often against people like Native American people who were evicted to make way for the first national parks in the United States, or indigenous people in East Africa who were evicted to make way for protected areas there by the British colonial government. So I have a kind of deep-seated concern for justice and fairness for those people in environmental terms. I see eco-justice as being a slightly different flavor of this concern for justice, and this is more related to interspecific justice. So the question of whether it's fair for humans to cause harm to non-humans for our own benefit, and a kind of increasing sensitivity to the possibility that we should be allocating rights or thinking about non-human life in a similar way to how we think about human life as something that, you know, where fairness comes into account, which, you know, I think is a really important consideration that we have to also bear in mind.
Yes, I think species, and this is just my personal opinion, like the orangutan or the koalas, do have a right to exist, and that we may have to make human sacrifices in order to do it. But I see your point that it's easy for you and I talking on a radio in rich countries to say, well, somebody in a jungle should move out or not be able to cut down the trees that they need because we feel strongly about those animals. So it's a very tough problem to solve.
It is exactly that. And you know, there are examples where conservation can be done in a way which is more respectful to local rights, and there's a whole kind of community conservation movement. There's a lot of attention now on giving local and indigenous people the right to manage and control land which they may wish to look after in a way which is beneficial for biodiversity. And you know, one of the areas where I think there is agreement between you know, myself and the authors of the Global Deal for Nature is exactly that. They're very keen on the idea of the protection of indigenous lands and giving indigenous people the right to manage those lands, and I would support that. Where I kind of get a bit concerned about it is I think the analysis that we have done shows that the kind of scale of the social impact really exceeds what we might think of as indigenous lands, you know, which are largely intact and with very low population densities of people. Many of these places that would need to be protected to achieve that Heart Earth vision are really much more intensely used and converted lands where people are living, you know, in a way that most of us wouldn't recognize as, you know, indigenous people in the normal way of thinking of that.
So in the end, does your group sort of come out against the Global Deal for Nature, or do you have modifications? I think you had three recommendations.
So the thing that we really are asking for in our study is for a little bit more clarity from the people who are proposing the Half Earth Plan or the Global Deal for Nature about exactly where they are asking for new protected areas to be created and what kind of protection they're advocating. Because one of the areas which is crucially important for understanding these proposals is how strict are we talking when we look at these protected areas? Are they very strict national parks in which no people can live or work, or are they somewhere on the spectrum down to much less restricted protected areas in which people can live, or through to indigenous lands which can be owned and managed by indigenous people, as I was just describing. And that makes a massive difference to how we understand the feasibility and the potential impact of this proposal. Because if we are talking about half the world in very, very strict, you know, wilderness areas, that is going to have an enormous impact on society and be very, very difficult to get global governments to agree to. But on the other hand, if we're talking about a wide range across that whole spectrum, that becomes a much more feasible plan, a much less risky plan, in my opinion, and one that, you know, I'd actually be willing to contemplate supporting. So that's a big part of what we're recommending, is for a bit more clarity about what's really being asked for. And then we're also asking for the parties that are negotiating the Convention on Biological Diversity post-2020 plan, which will be agreed in China in October of 2020. We're asking them to really think a bit more holistically about understanding what all the social implications of protected areas might be, and to make sure that the plan they come up with isn't just fixated with a big scaling up of the global protected area estate, but also looks really seriously at the underlying drivers of biodiversity loss in the industrialized north.
And there you are talking about production and consumption, and I agree with you 100%. As long as we continue to eat up the resources of the world, it's hard to see how we'll protect any of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of fairness, you know, you just made the point a moment ago about, you know, it's easy for us to be here, you know, talking from our positions of privilege, relative privilege in the world, whilst, you know, people that I used to work with in rural Uganda, you know, really suffering the consequences of living outside a protected area which is conserving mountain gorillas for the global good. And I feel much more comfortable about the idea that we might, as a global society, ask those people to make some sacrifices on our behalf to keep those species alive, if we are also willing to make those sacrifices or a different kind of sacrifice in our own lives, which might mean changing the food we eat, it might mean changing the car we drive, it might mean flying less, it might mean voting for and lawmakers who are going to take action on these issues. So I feel that having that balance is what gives conservation some legitimacy to ask for actions elsewhere in the world.
Are there other alternative sort of plan B being advanced by a broad coalition of conservation groups or academics or international institutions? Do we have other ways of going if we don't go this way?
Well, I'm not sure that there's another kind of big, glamorous plan in quite the same way as there is with the Global Deal for Nature. I think various people feel that we can carry on with a kind of incremental growth in the protected area estate, really focusing on investing in what we've got and making sure that it works, and tackling the underlying drivers of biodiversity loss in a way that could be as or even more effective for conservation than going for these big jumping forward targets. I published a paper a few years ago with some other colleagues in which we called for what we called whole earth instead of half earth. And this was really arguing that rather than keeping pushing for these big numbers, we should also be thinking about the kind of production side the consumption side of the global economy, which we've just been discussing. And one of the other points we made in that paper is there's a big problem, in my view, with this language of us and them. So half earth, kind of half the nature, half the people, just really reinforces this linguistic discursive divide between humans on the one hand and nature on the other. And, I believe, as I think we all do when we stop and think about it, that people are part of nature. And I think, we need to come up with a much more integrated vision for how we can live on Earth and share it with other species, of which, we are a part of these systems. So I get quite worried about this notion of humans in one place and nature everywhere else. I don't feel like that's a sustainable plan to aim for.
I do admit, Chris, I was a little worried that your paper might stoke doubts and caveats that are used by countries all too easily to stall or evade the really strong measures that we need to save the natural world. Do you have those concerns as you worked on this?
Well, yeah, I suppose I wouldn't say I had those concerns in doing this work, because I genuinely felt that it was really important to answer this question. And actually going into this research, I really had no idea what the number would be that we came out with. And I just thought it was a very important piece of information for the conservation community and the policy community to have to hand. I do worry, actually, that going for a really big, radical kind of half-earth plan might actually completely backfire for conservation. So, as someone who cares about conservation, I think we need a plan that is going to work politically and socially and ecologically. And if we go for a very radical plan, which could be implemented in a very heavy-handed way, I worry that that would completely undermine any future support for conservation and could actually undermine conservation success. So I don't see this work – well, first of all, I don't see this work as taking a position very strongly one way or the other about the Global Deal for Nature. I see it as a useful context for those discussions. But also I think if we did go for a very, very strong and kind of high-end ask, I worry that it won't work out well for conservation in the long term. And as someone who does care about conservation, I would be disappointed about that.
Yes, and you've been on the ground to see it. So what is a political ecologist, and why did you go in that direction?
Sure. So I started out as a conservation scientist. My undergraduate degree and my master's degree were both in zoology and conservation science. And I then increasingly came to the realization that conservation is fundamentally a human issue and a social issue. So if we're going to address the impact that people are having on nature, on non-human nature, we need to understand people and processes that are social and political at heart. So I went and studied for my PhD in anthropology. I went and looked at the impact of tourism on mountain gorillas and local people living around a national park in Uganda. And from there, I've ended up in geography, and I now see myself most closely associated with a field called political ecology. And political ecologists are interested in the relationship between people and their non-human environment, and particularly how that relationship is shaped by political and economic forces. So things like the way in which we organize our economy, so under capitalism or under alternative forms of management, and how issues kind of interact across multiple scales to shape the things that we see happening on the ground. So in a sense, it's trying to take the really big picture to understand what is going on at the local scale. So rather than just looking at okay, you know, these people are cutting down these forests. What can we do to stop that happening? We tried to ask ourselves, you know, why are these people cutting down the forest, and how is that shaped by historical factors, by economic factors, by cultural factors? And in so doing, I think political ecologists are able to shed a lot of very useful light to help us understand, you know, what some of the problems are that we're facing in conservation, and occasionally, although not always, offer some useful suggestions for how we could improve that situation.
And as we wrap up, could you tell us about some of the conservation leaders you have helped train at the specialized master's program at Cambridge and maybe where they are now?
Yeah, sure, be happy to. So we established the master's in 2010, and it trained established professional conservationists from around the world. So we've now had students from over 80 different countries across those first 10 years, and we give them applied leadership and management skills as well as cutting-edge interdisciplinary academic training. And they work with a whole group of conservation charities that are based with us in Cambridge in England as part of their studies. And they are going on to, you know, really important roles in both governments and in the charity sector and in the private sector. Just as a couple of examples, we have one of our students, alumna from Guyana, is now the Deputy Commissioner of Protected Areas for Guyana in South America. We have several students who are in leadership roles in international charities working in Eastern and Southern Africa. They're really going off to make a big difference for conservation, and it's absolutely wonderful to see them going out and putting into practice what we've helped them with during their studies.
From the University of Cambridge, we've been speaking with Dr. Chris Sandbrook, and I will put links to the paper we've been talking about in my show blog, and you can find updates from time to time from Chris Sandbrook in the blog thinkinglikeahuman.wordpress.com. Chris, thank you for sharing your time with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Now I'd like to finish by reading the final paragraph of my book, Half Earth. We should forever bear in mind that the beautiful world that our species inherited took the biosphere 3.5 billion years to create. The intricacy of the species we know only in part, and the way they work together to create a sustainable balance we have only recently begun to grasp. Like it or not, prepared or not, we are the minds and the stewards of the living world. Our own ultimate future depends upon that understanding. We have come a very long way through the barbaric period in which we still, unfortunately, live. And now I believe we've learned enough to adopt a transcendent moral precept concerning the rest of life on this planet. It's easy to say, do no further harm to the biosphere. Thank you.